Rain washed the toxic smog from Tehran's sky as I stood on my brother's balcony, gripped by inexplicable anxiety. I had just finished documenting Iran's execution of children, including a 16-year-old girl killed for crimes against chastity by a judge who personally acted as her executioner. Driving home through empty streets, I found a note thumbtacked to my door. "If you go on as you are now, we will be forced to end your life. Killing you is the easiest thing we could do." This wasn't the first threat I'd received, but something about that rainy evening felt different. How does a person continue fighting when the cost keeps rising? When your own government becomes your stalker, your tormentor, your thief? This memoir reveals what happens when you refuse to stop, when you choose principle over safety, country over comfort, truth over survival. It's the story of how a Nobel Peace Prize laureate was systematically stripped of everything, her office, her home, her marriage, even the medal itself. Yet somehow, the one thing they couldn't take was her voice. My connection to Iran ran deeper than reason. When friends fled during the 1980s war with Iraq and the Islamic government's rise, I stayed, even as authorities stripped my judgeship, demoting me to clerk in my own court. I remained as Iraqi warplanes reduced our street to rubble. Through revolution, war, and upheaval, my husband Javad and I raised our daughters while maintaining normal family life. When the judiciary became exclusively male, I reinvented myself professionally. The early 1990s revealed a corrupt legal system where files vanished without bribes. 11-year-old Layla's case, raped and murdered, exposed the system's cruelty. Her family had to pay for her killer's execution, and when they couldn't, the men walked free. This injustice shaped my second career. I began using Islamic principles to challenge discriminatory laws against women, working within the framework while advocating for human rights, a strategy that would earn international recognition and powerful enemies. The 2003 Nobel Peace Prize advanced my work while irritating the government. I used the prize money to purchase an apartment for the Defenders of Human Rights Center, bringing lawyers together to defend political prisoners pro bono. That same year, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad became Tehran's mayor, burying newly found Iran-Iraq war remains in 72 of Tehran's parks and squares, transforming beloved public spaces into makeshift cemeteries, particularly enraging young Iranians who relied on these rare socializing spaces. Tehran transformed under Ahmadinejad's radical vision. Separate elevators for men and women, purges of municipal workers, murals glorifying Palestinian suicide bombers. After my Nobel Prize, surveillance intensified. State-assigned bodyguards monitored my movements, phones were bugged, and I removed my mobile battery at home to prevent eavesdropping. Iran holds 16 million landmines from the Iraq War, the world's second highest number, regularly killing farmers and children. I established Iran's first demining NGO, raising awareness while helping victims afford prosthetics. In February 2004, a supposed government official brought an American Stanford professor to my office, requesting I purchase mine removal equipment blocked by sanctions. When pressed, he admitted the component could make centrifuges. Years later, I realized they were likely intelligence agents exploiting my international standing. Visiting clients at Evin Prison in spring 2005, I found prominent journalist Akbar Ganji without representation. He'd exposed state complicity in political assassinations and was now on hunger strike. I took his case immediately, but Tehran's prosecutor banned my visits. Intelligence agents routinely appeared at my office, expressing concerns about my work. On June 12, 2006, women's rights activists gathered at Tehran's 7th of Tahrir Square with banners reading, "Why We Don't Consider the Present Laws Just." Police in riot gear violently dispersed them with tear gas, dragging women by their headscarves into vans. This crackdown sparked the 1 million signatures campaign. When authorities blocked their launch meeting, activists began organizing door-to-door conversations nationwide. The movement trained ordinary women to explain legal discrimination to neighbors, a mother's inability to make medical decisions for her child without the father's permission, or unequal inheritance rights. By framing issues in everyday terms, they made abstract legal concepts tangible, helping millions of Iranian women understand how the law systematically disadvantaged them. In June 2009, Iran held an election that changed everything. The reformist campaign filled Tehran's streets with green ribbons and palpable energy for change. While I was in Majorca for a speaking engagement, shocking news arrived. Despite massive reformist turnout, Ahmadinejad was declared winner with 24 million votes. The count came suspiciously fast, and neither reformist candidate carried their hometown, unthinkable in Iranian politics. When Supreme Leader Khamenei immediately congratulated Ahmadinejad, the outcome was sealed. Iranians refused to accept it. On June 15th, millions flooded Tehran's streets in the largest demonstration since the 1979 revolution, marching silently with signs reading, "Where is my vote?" Authorities fired on protesters, killing at least two. From my hotel, I frantically called colleagues, some arrested, others hiding. "This is a coup. Don't come back," one warned. At Amsterdam Airport, I stood at the Tehran departure gate watching others board. At the last moment, I pulled back, perhaps the most fateful decision of my life. Instead of returning home, I took a train to my daughter's in The Hague. I didn't know then I would never see my country again. From my daughter's riverside flat, I watched the regime unleash violence against protesters. When Nida Aga Sultan was shot by a militiaman, her face became the icon of regime brutality. I spoke regularly to international media while authorities summoned my Tehran colleagues for interrogations. A clear message: stay silent and we'll let you return. I refused. In August 2009, Javad called with a shaky voice. Intelligence agents had lured him to an apartment, filmed him in a compromising situation, and arrested him. A judge sentenced him to death by stoning for adultery, refusing legal representation. Agent Mahmoudi demanded Javad denounce me on camera in exchange for freedom, claiming I didn't deserve the Nobel Prize and was working for Western powers. In December 2009, Mahmoudi confiscated our safe deposit box containing my Nobel medal, creating international uproar as the first Nobel Peace Prize ever seized. Shortly after, agents detained my sister Nushen in solitary confinement for 21 days. The authorities seized my properties at artificially low prices, including our beloved orchard. I asked close friends to bid. I would never again see those trees heavy with spring fruit, but at least Mahmoudi wouldn't either. I share this story to bear witness to what Iranians endure under a police state. If a Nobel Peace Laureate with media access and legal expertise can be treated this way, imagine what happens to ordinary Iranians, journalists, lawyers, women's rights activists, and students whose talents waste away in cells. Despite losing more than I thought possible, I continue working for Iran's freedom. I established the Center for Supporters of Human Rights in London, connecting Iranian lawyers inside and outside the country. Though divorce from Javad brought profound emptiness, I intensified my work, finding purpose in advocating for the Iranian people. Despite exile, I still dream of returning to Tehran, to the orchard Javad and I planted. I carry poet Simon Behbahani's words, "My country, I shall build you again, even if with bricks of my life." In a world where silence feels safer than speech, remember, freedom is never granted by oppressors. It's claimed by the oppressed. Until we are free, the fight continues.